It is important to point out that the Mosse Art Research Initiative is not a restitution initiative or restitution project, but a research project, you know. And that is why that I, as a researcher, I am more interested in questions on the history and Nazi policy and all this stuff, not only in finding artworks or locating them.
Welcome to Warfare of Art and Law, the podcast that focuses on how justice does or doesn't play out when art and law overlap. Hey everyone, it's Stephanie, and that was Dr. Micah Hoffman with the Mosse Art Research Initiative, known as MARI, the first collaboration between German public institutions and Holocaust victims. In the following conversation, Dr. Hoffman shares how MARI began and gives examples of pieces that have been located and recovered due to the provenance research being done by MARI. She also shares how the work of MARI is helping to achieve historical justice. And we close with Dr. Hoffman sharing about her work on the Gurlitt Art Trove and her work as a curator for the 2019 exhibition Escape into Art, that featured artists labeled degenerate under the Third Reich. Dr. Micah Hoffman, welcome to Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Would you start by describing your thoughts on why it's important to reconstruct and research art and antiquity collections looted by the Nazis, like the Mosse collection?
Yes, sure, I will. I think it is, of course, not only important in case of restitutions. I think it is maybe even more important to work with our past. I was thinking about a special term. How would you translate Erinnerungskultur? I think you don't have this term. It's like remembrance culture. In Germany, you know?
Yes, I saw that term, German culture of memory.
Yeah, German culture of memory, yes. I think the MARI project is so important because it was the very first project in which descendants of victims of Nazi persecution collaborated together with German public institutions. And I think this communication between both sides is so important to work on a culture of memory together. You know, I think there should be an international culture of memory in terms of the Nazi time, not only a culture of memory in Germany. And this is so important. And this is what interests me really a lot, to talk to the people, to talk to the descendants of the victims. And not only research the location of the items. But of course, I understand the interests of the heirs. And for me as a scholar, it is also important to find these artworks, first to identify them, to find these artworks, to reconstruct the collection, and to get more insight into the private collections back then, at that time, you know. And to reestablish a memory on the victims, on Rudolf Mosse, and so on, because this was very important for the German culture as well. And so there are also a lot of art historical questions.
For the art historical questions, are there a few examples that you have come to conclusions with during your work at MARI?
Yes, of course. For example, I think that Rudolf Mosse understands himself not as an art expert, but as an art lover, you know. He collected especially artworks from the second half of the 19th century German art because he was himself an art lover of these pictures, realistic depiction of the city, of the people at that time, of landscapes, but he was not in front of modern artworks, for example. So with the reconstruction of his collection, we were able to find out that Rudolf Mosse collected artworks not because of the art itself, but to express himself or his cultural, political intention. Do you understand what I mean? And so, of course, this is of art historical interest, but at the same time, when we know the intention of Rudolf Mosse to build up a collection, there are also important facts to help to find the single artworks. So it is a mixture of provenance research questions and, of course, art historical questions. And both questions will help to find resolutions or to finish our project.
Is there a work that you have located having had that kind of information about his taste and creating the collection so that it was easier to locate the object because of knowing that?
Well, for example, Rudolf Mosse was very interested in famous people of his time, especially politicians, for example, or not only politicians, but yes, people who were involved in the big culture scene, so to say. And for example, the writer Theodor Fontane, he loved his poems, and he purchased a portrait of Theodor Fontane by the Berlin painter Hans Fechner. Not very well known, internationally well known, but for Berlin at that time, it was a very well-known painter. When we were able to identify this picture, of course, we will find traces to the place where this painting could be today much more easier, because we know we have to look in maybe similar collections, for example, of portraits with important persons of that time. And it's not only one fact which leads us to the location. There are many aspects, of course, and to be flexible in your research, that is important and brings you to a result. And the painting, for example, by Hans Fechner, we were able to locate in Germany, and from the auction it was purchased by Hjalmar Schacht, who was the Reichsfinanzminister of Adolf Hitler, and he inherited the painting to his daughter Cordula Schacht, who is still alive and a jurist. And as you can see, it is in private possession today, but the daughter is not open for discussions, and she would have to give it back or to restitute it, because it is private property, of course. But yes, we know that the profile of the collection of Hjalmar Schacht was that kind. You know, he was also interested in German politicians or writer or painter at that time, who were symbols, for example, of the empire.
That painting is like the others that you've located. Would it have been listed on the Lost Art Database, which would make it difficult to auction if the family ever did want to sell it? Is that the case?
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that Cordula Schacht will do so.
So looking at the MARI website, there was a discussion of how the documents that you have available to you from, say, the Mosse publishing catalogs that they created for their exhibitions that they did at the Mosse Palais were missing lots of information about perhaps even the full name of the artist or the dimensions of the work. The titles are sometimes perhaps not the titles used today. And so between that and the Nazi inventory and some correspondence, is that the universe of documents that you have with clues about how to reconstruct this collection, or is there more like the clues you're talking about?
Yes, of course, there are much more documents that are important to the project. But we started with these documents and we were able to find, I don't know exactly, I think about six more catalogs of Rudolf Moss's collection. And you are correct, there are only rare information about the artworks themselves. There are no pictures, so it is very hard to identify them. But of course, it is a good start, or it was a good start. And also these collection catalogs are very important to understand why Rudolf Moss collected art. They are the catalogs also confirm his attitude that he was not an expert, and that is why he was not interested in measurement or details of the artworks. He only wanted to show his possession, you know, and of course he wanted to show in which room he hung the portrait of Theodor Fechner, for example, together with other portraits of Bismarck and so on. That was important for him to show show again his cultural, political attitude to his own time. That was important for him. And that is what these catalogs are telling us today, but no art historical details. But it was a good start to identify the artworks. And yes, so the first steps were to do art historical research, to look if there are catalog raisonné about the artist, if there are exhibition catalogs on the artist, and so on. You know, these are very common art historical steps or methods that we had to go through at first to identify the art, the items. But this is also the double challenge on the project. That it is not like provenance research in museums where you can work with the artworks themselves because there are many traces at the backside, for example. But we first have to identify them. And when we are able to identify the single artwork, the individual artworks, then we can start to research the single steps or the individual possessor or the until the location today.
One of the characteristics of Moss's collection that struck me was that he was one of the rare patrons who had large sculpture, and one of the ones that I noticed had been localized by Mari was Venus Chasing Cupid. And I was curious if you could describe the research process for that piece.
This is by Eberlein.
Yeah.
Do you have in mind the one in Hannover Schminden?
Yes, that's the one.
It was one of the last artworks or sculptures that we were able to localize during the first funding phase. And we started the communication with the museum, and then they started their own research. So there are some gaps in the provenance, and we will continue with the research a little bit, but we were able to identify the sculpture by a painting in a kind of catalog raisonné. And because it is a marmor sculpture, there are only one version of the sculpture. So it is a original artwork, like paintings, and different, for example, to prints or sculptures out of bronze. These are multiple artworks.
That piece was not in the Lepke catalog, correct?
Most of the sculptures were not or not part of the auction catalog. That is right. And we are still looking for an answer of that. In this, for example, this Eberlein, maybe One reason is that these artworks are of a huge size, but I think this is not the only answer. It could be that there were, because we know of some requests from the auction house to selected persons, are you interested in this artwork? Then we will keep it out from the auction and sell it to you. So this could also be a reason. Nazis were very interested in sculptures or in monumental artworks. And this could be a reason, but yes, we don't know exactly. So this will be definitely a topic that we will research. Well, we will continue our research in this topic.
The listing on Mari had mentioned that information, I think, had been given in early 2019 to the city about the sculpture. Is that the kind of thing that Mari would do to start the dialogue and then go back and forth with determining any gaps in the provenance, like you mentioned? Is that directly between you and either a museum curator or the city representative?
Yes. Yes, of course, we start with the research by ourselves. And when we have important information on the provenance or the whereabouts, and or we were able to locate it, of course, then we will go into a dialogue with the museum and ask them for their documentation. In many times, we help the museum to research the provenances of their own collection because sometimes they don't have a complete documentation or they are not able to research provenances, for example. This is the kind of collaboration with many other museums in Germany. And this was the first idea to establish a project like MARI to also help other German museums with the research and not to send provenance researcher into every single German museum and start the research on Mosse and his collection from the scratch, you know.
And the same for Israeli museums. Would you also be assisting their curatorial staff when you mention a piece to them? Like, what comes to mind is the Tel Aviv Museum having, at this point, three pieces, I believe, two tapestries and the Joseph Israels From Darkness to Light.
Yes. The painting by Israels was the first one we were able to localize at the Tel Aviv Museum, and we shared all our information, which was quite a lot on the Israel painting. We shared all our information with the staff of the Tel Aviv Museum, and they in return sent us photos of the artwork from the front and from the back. And so we were able to finish the provenance chain and answer all questions that that are combined to the painting. This was, I think, an ideal research and core. And the Bose tapestry, in actual fact, they are three, because these Bose tapestries were donated to the Tel Aviv Museum by a Jewish collector who himself has a private museum in Jerusalem, the Erich Wolf, Wolfson Museum, and they held another piece of that. There are five tapestries of this series. And they hold another one, but they have a private museum, And we, of course, already get in contact with the Erich Wolfson Museum, but they refused our request. And the staff of the Tel Aviv Museum, after we get in contact with them and send our provenance information, started a research by themselves or look through their museum documentation. And the only thing they know is, or we know today, is that Erich Wolfson purchased the three tapestries from Sotheby's in the 1970s, I think. And then after that, gave two of the tapestries to the Tel Aviv Museum. And also the painting by Israel was a donation from a private collector. And yes, I have to say that this is, of course, for research or, you know, in the cosmos of restitution, it is, for me, the restitution has a bad taste, because, of course, I don't like to ask Israel museums to give something back. And when you compare it with the case of Cordula Schacht, she herself possess this painting, or still has the painting from the former Mosse collection. She never gave donations to public institutions. So yeah, the painting will stay with her. And at the other side, the Tel Aviv Museum has to restitute all these things they get as donations.
Although that particular painting, the Israel's painting, they purchased it to be able to keep in their collection. Is that right? And with a label?
Yes. The Mosse heirs find a consensual solution with the museum that they were able to keep it there, because it is important for their collection of 19th century European painting. Mm-hmm.
And the label notes that it was restituted.
Yes, yeah, that is important.
Many people categorize that perhaps as achieving historical justice in those types of situations. Would you agree?
Yes, I would, definitely. And I think that it is important to make the history visible, of course. Only in that way we can show the fate of the victims and try to not to compensate them, but to work and to memorize of what happened back then. You know, I wish that German museums did that at the same way. There are more and more exhibitions here, or more institutions make the history or the provenances visible at the labels, but not all. And of course, the family, the Mosse family, is very interested not only in restitutions, but also in the memory of Rudolf Mosse. Mm-hmm.
And also looking at the wider impact of Mari, the Tel Aviv's approach that they now are researching more closely for other Nazi-looted objects in their collection. So that's perhaps the hope for all collections, that people would take a more scrutinizing look at what they have and the provenance.
Yes, especially in the case of the Rudolf Mosse collection, I think it is not visible for the institution or the provenance researcher there, because, you know, Rudolf Mosse died in 1920s. So at the first glance, there is no connection to the Nazi time, because Erna Felicia and Hans Lachmann Mosse kept the name Rudolf Mosse Collection. And that was the title of the auction catalog in 1935. But yes, at the first glance, it was not confiscated by the Nazis. So that is why I think many museums, as well as in Tel Aviv or in Israel, as well as in Germany or Austria, were not aware that Rudolf Mosse is definitely a case of Nazi persecution.
Mm-hmm. How many pieces is it assumed that were in this collection, in addition to art. There were antiquities and objects from Egyptian digs, Benin bronzes, a library that was rather voluminous, I understand. As a whole, is it currently still hard to know how large it was?
Yes, it is very hard because there exists assumptions that the collection was about 5,000 pieces or included 5,000 pieces. But as we realized during our research, there was, I think, a collection or a there was a collection of paintings and works on paper, around 200 pieces, I think. And the sculptures maybe were around 70, 80 pieces. And that is the core of the collection. And then you can add the antiquities, the furniture, the handicrafts. And yes, there are a lot of pieces, but these pieces are really very difficult to find, you know.
Mari started in early 2017. Has the approach that you had in that first phase of research and then what you'll do now, is it has the approach changed at all, or is it the same protocol but more in-depth looks at certain objects?
Because of our in-depth research in the first funding phase, we were able to establish individual art dealers who are known only a little until today. And we now want to look more closely to them. And it is also very difficult because, for example, we came across the name of Elisabeth Litauer, who was a niece of Rudolf Mosse, and she herself was persecuted by the Nazis and left in 1936, but before that, we assume that she was engaged in selling the family collection of the families Mosse and Lachmann. And there are many branches of these families connected with other famous families, as, for example, the Liebermann family from the artist Liebermann. And now we want to research these individual family collection to be more precise, for example, about the auction catalog. There are not only pieces from the former Rudolf Mosse collection that we know for sure. There are some items from other family collection. And yes, this is one important topic of our new research period now.
Mm-hmm. The staff that's used for Mari, it ranges from students to at the Free University to yourself and some other researchers, where I'd seen, for example, the Nymph Fountain at Bergschlitz. I'd seen where there was a researcher dedicated to that particular work. Mm-hmm. But she was speaking to the press, so I'm not sure if they got that right. So I was curious, are researchers or historians assigned to certain works? Or I know that this is a very interdisciplinary project, so I was curious how that worked.
This is correct, because it is important to find experts for the single epochs or techniques, for example. And so each member has his list of works he or she is researching. But of course, every month we meet one day and talk a lot about our research results, because it is very important to know about the research results from all team members, of course. We all work together on the single pieces, but it is true that There is, for example, a provenance researcher for the paintings of the 19th century and one provenance researcher, for example, for the sculptures, because they are specialized in. But then when we have a special amount of results, then we talk about that and think about the next steps. I think this is a very good model or structure because, for example, during the Gurlitt research, everything was secret and there was no transparency and nobody knows about the research results of the other researcher. And this is a common way, so to say, but because we are a research project at a university, you know, and the university is funded with public funding, we have to be transparent. And I, in my function as a coordinator, I am allowed to talk to colleagues, to other experts. And that is very important. And that is also a point this is also, I think, a reason why the project is so successful, because I can be open, I can talk to my colleagues, I can exchange information. Provenance researcher in common are not, you understand, if they do their research for a museum or, for example, for the heirs, then they are not allowed to speak very openly about their research results.
Your experience with the Gurlitt collection research, did that shape how you modeled the Mari work with that kind of improvement of transparency?
Definitely, because if I would have been the coordinator of the Gurlitt project, I would have done it in another way. So when I was only a researcher, you know, and I was a member of the task force, of course. But yes, and it was really the transparency, and it was the fact that each researcher didn't know about the other results that I find very ineffective and misleading.
The portal database for Mari has what I read were open source modules, and I wasn't sure if you could describe what that means.
You know, one of I'm an art historian, you know, and for me it is very difficult to explain the technical terms of our portal. But what is new at our portal is that we started with the resources and not with the objects themselves. You know, we try to transcribe all the resources we were able to find. And we did so because, you know, in the future, maybe all these written information can connect in the World Wide Web automatically. So the Mosse heirs finance this technical part of the project so that we were able to create such a portal. The DZK, the German Lost Art Foundation, is not allowed to fund the technique or own documentation portals or something like that. But I think it is very important because it is not only that we document our results in the Mari portal, we also used it as a tool. Because every team member is able to put his own research results into the portal, and these information can connect to other information. And so we get more information, at least, as only documented or in tabellen or something like that. The portal is really tailored on the task of provenance research, and that is really an important point of the project and of the success of the project, I think. And the heirs are very happy about the portal because our project is very visible. And yes, it is also, of course, that via the portal, we can publish our research results not only to experts or colleagues, but also to the broader audience, maybe who are interested in these topics, but maybe are no experts. And that is also why we divided our results into three zones: a popular short comment on our research results, but then you can step for step go deeper until you can find a provenance change and all these transcriptions from the resources in detail. You will find every source we get information from and can find, yes, every written word in there if you want to. But you can also only grasp a short view of our research.
The goal was to create usability and promote new findings?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When they had the Washington conference, they had envisioned a mega website where information could be shared. Is there any other type of website besides the MARI portal that you know of that has that kind of interconnectivity?
Yes, there is another website in Munich, which was created by the staff of the Zentralinstitut für Kunstgeschichte, but it is not online until now, I think. But I talked a lot to my colleagues there, and they created the database on a very similar model. So I think this is really a future model. And that means also open source, because it can be connected to every other software, you know. And I think in the future, I hope we can have such a meta portal where every collection reconstructions can be published and or centralized, you know, that you don't have to search for all these databases by your own, but to have it in a meta portal. Yes.
I'd read that you had created the first academic training on provenance research. When was that, and how has it informed what you're doing now?
Yes, yeah. I created that training program in 2011 together with other colleagues. And yes, I still offer these training program today. And one of the important points of my provenance research project is also that I always include my students in the project in the way that I offer classes on the reconstruction of the Mosse collection, for example. Students, of course, are not able to conduct provenance research probably, but they are, of course, able to start with identifying the artworks, because this is art historical work, you know, and they are able to systematically research literature, catalogs raisonné, exhibition catalogs. And that is the first step into our research. And in that way, I included the students into the project. And they are very thankful for that, because that motivates them. And they are part of the project. And it's not only a theoretical work in art history.
Is there an object from the Mosse collection that you've researched thus far that would best represent the challenges of provenance research that you've encountered, that sort of encapsulates the type of troubling issues that you deal with?
I really want to find a painting by Adolf Menzel. And it is very difficult to find any traces of this painting. We know until today that it was auctioned in 1934, but we have no idea to whom, and we found no traces so far. And we think that is because the painting vanished into a private collection. And when the collector is not interested in exhibiting the painting or publishing it in exhibition catalogs or inventories or something like that, it is very difficult to find traces of the painting. And I think because the Mosser collection included some masterpieces, but many artworks of a minor value. And that is why many of these paintings or prints or statues went to private collections. And it is very difficult to find these paintings or even to identify them.
With the wide variety of work that's in the Mosser collection for expertise on certain objects, do you ever find that you need to reach out to another researcher outside of the MARI program? And I'm thinking of something like antiquities from Egypt or Ethiopia.
We always do that. We always try to get in contact with expert on the artist, the genre, the technique, the epoch, of course, every time. For example, the Benin bronzes. We had only a little knowledge about Benin bronzes and the art market on Benin bronzes, you know, and we depend on help from our colleagues and experts. Yes, we always do that. And we not only collaborate with museums in Germany, but all over the world, especially in America. We had many colleagues and of course, for example, in the case of the Gary Melchers painting that was restituted last year. It was very important to know about the art market in America and the US. Yes, this is of course an aspect of our research.
Mm-hmm. I'd read about a 2018 auction that was to include a Benin commemorative head and wall panels. And the article I read said that they had worked with the Mosser family to arrange for ownership so that they could sell the works at auction. And since that was just after MARI started, I wondered if you'd had any involvement with those pieces.
No, because the Mosser family let conduct provenance research before MARI as well with their own researcher. But when it came to light that there are some museums in Europe who have Mosser pieces in their collection, then the idea of the MARI project was started by Hermann Patzinger, for example, the head of the Prussian property here in Berlin, who returned, I think, around about 8 pieces from the Mosser collection to the heirs before MARI started. Yes, and he, together with Isabel Pfeiffer-Prinzkin, who is now culture minister of Nordrhein-Westfalen, these both people had the idea to create a project in which the descendants of victims, together with German museums, should cooperate, and they get in contact with the Mosser heirs. But there was research before MARI started, of course, yeah. But we took over some cases that were not finished, for example, and now, at that time, we are the only, the MARI project took over the complete research, you know.
The Free University, it had hosted the Gurlitt work that you did. Is that right?
This is really a complicated structure because I worked on Hildebrand Gurlitt years before the Gurlitt story popped up in the media, because Gurlitt was one of the art dealers of degenerate art, artworks, modern artworks that were seized by the Nazis from German public collections. And of course, Hildebrand Gurlitt was always important for me and for my research team at the Degenerative Art Research Center at the Free University. And I think it was around maybe half a year before the Gurlitt case, my colleague was able to purchase around 119 business letters from Hildebrand Gurlitt to French art dealers from the 1940s, yes, from the 1940s, 1943, 1944, 1945, very, very important business letters. And then we started a research project, but only a little one. And that is why I was asked by the public prosecutors of the city of Augsburg if I can help them with an expertise on the trove. And at first they gave me photographs, and then I was able to establish very quickly that there are a lot, that there are a lot of prints and drawings and watercolors, only one painting, two paintings, and two paintings that were seized as degenerate art by the Nazis in 1937. And that is why I was asked by them to write a report. And after I did that, only on the pieces of degenerate art, they asked me to do a little further research on the Matisse painting. It was not degenerate art, of course, but it was modern art, and I know modern collections or collection of modern art, and that is why they asked me. And yes, that was my work. And when the Gurlitt trove became public and the task force was established by the German government, I had my own small project at the Free University, and I researched with two other provenance researcher, very well-known, internationally well-known provenance researcher, the provenances of the Matisse painting and the Liebermann painting. And these were the first two paintings that were restituted from the Gurlitt trove. Yes. Mm-hmm. And after that, I take over some more research on the degenerate art in the Gurlitt trove.
Did this play a role in creating the university's Department of History and Cultural Studies on degenerate art and Nazi-looted art? Or was that already in place before you were doing this work?
The Degenerate Art Research Center was already in place. It was started in 2003, and I started my work at the research center in 2006. But I started then with the database, and that was my main task then, to build up a database on the seized art, on the degenerate art. And I think this database was the first tool for provenance researcher worldwide. It was bilingual, German-English, and it was published in 2010. So in actual fact, we were the first ones who built up such a tool for provenance researcher. Now there are a lot, of course. But I think it was also because that Hermann Patzinger suggests me for the research, for the coordinator of the MARI project, because I'm not an expert on looted art, but I know how to reconstruct collections, because this is the same research I did for years on the degenerate artworks. The Nazis seized around 100 German museums, and we tried, the team of the research center tried to reconstruct these collection, and we already started with basic documents, not from, we don't start from the objects, we start from the documents. And we first had to identify the artworks. And this is the same way we started in Mari, you know. And this is a different research to the provenance researcher who are working for museums with the collection.
How did you come to decide on the field of provenance research for your focus?
At first, I worked for 5 years in a museum here in Berlin, in the Brücke Museum, after I finished my studies, and I liked it very much. I have to say, I like to work as a curator. I was specialized on expressionism, especially the Brücke painters. One time I was asked by a sponsor if I have interest to work for the Degenerate Art Research Center at the Free University because there were a lot of expressionist painters that were defamed by the Nazis and their works were seized from the German museums. So I was at that time no expert on Nazi policy, art policy, but I was back then very interested in what happened to not the individual artworks, but what happened to the painters. What happened, you know, in the 1920s, the expressionists became very well known because there were a lot of public museums who started to collect their works. I became interested in provenance research because I wanted to know what happened to our culture, to our German culture, or what impact had the Nazi policy and the defamation and the seizure on the development after the Second World War. And all these involvements were very interesting for me. And then I became a member of the International Circle of Provenance Researcher, I think in 2008. Then I started to think about a training program because already at that time, it was very clear that we have that we need more members and that we need a new generation, or that we had to care about a new generation of provenance researcher because there were so many cases and such a lot of work to do. And because I worked for a university, of course, it was my part to think more and more about it and to, elaborate a training program. And in 2011, it was, we started with lectures. And after the Gulit case, you know that it was the point where we and my colleagues had enough experience to give advice to the other cities or universities to start with their own training programs or build up professorships on provenance research. And today, quite more than 20 years ago or 10 years ago.
The programs like even the German-American Provenance Exchange Program from a few years ago. Is there anything like that or like you were just talking about that you would recommend to someone who is interested in provenance research as a field or already is in the field and wants to hone their skills more in this area?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is for the future, we should build up more of these international networks. I think the network is still very good, but provenance research really depends on networking more than art historical research or historical research, I think. And that is why networking is so important for provenance research. And maybe this is an aspect that distinguishes provenance research from other historical research. And that is why. And also, as I already said, it is important the research so that not every researcher in the individual institution has to start his own research. If we have more these projects like MARI or the exchange program you mentioned, I think we will come to our results more quickly, and the research will be more efficient than we started, you know, in 2013 or 2014. In fact, there was no structure of provenance research project. Or the first step to establish provenance research was, of course, to research the collection of the German museums, because that was one of the Washington principles. And that is why we started with all these single small projects in the institutions. Nowadays, we know that the historical context is so important for these individual provenance research projects that we have to think on a broader base, I think, to conduct provenance research. And therefore, the international network is so important. I also think that we are on a good way, and that there will be more of these big international projects in the future, because we know, all provenance experts know very well how important networks are and the interchange or the exchange of information. It is not possible for a single person to research a collection by their own.
Exhibitions that put the focus on provenance research. There's one at the Victoria and Albert Museum. I was curious if you knew of any others that you would recommend, or that in the past you'd seen that you thought were insightful.
There are a lot of exhibitions in Germany as well as in Switzerland. And let me think, also in France, I think, after the Gurlitz case, that is true, the museum think about, exhibiting their research results. And there are different ways to do so. I think the easiest way is to put on labels and tell the provenance history of the single items. But there are also, for example, initiatives to ask artists to create artworks on that subject, to try to translate, so to say, our research into new artworks, or put them in comparison or in the neighborhood of seized artworks, or that kind of working with the historical subject and with the fact of art looting. And there are many, I think there are many interesting formats of exhibitions, the idea developed to include provenance research or the results of provenance research into exhibitions. There are many ways, but I find it very important not to to think of provenance research or to display provenance research results from time to time, but to include it into the permanent display as well, because it is part of the museum history and it has to be visible all the time in what way ever.
And for the programs you were talking about where artists would create new work based off of the research, are there any that come to mind?
Yeah, for example, Maria Eichhorn was asked to perform art looting or provenance research or restitution at the Documenta in Kassel. And I think she is today the most well-known who is specialized on that subject. And with the bullet case, she started with that special artwork.
Going back to your interest in the reputations of artists after World War II that had been defamed by being labeled as degenerate, are there any writings about that that you would recommend or any information if someone wanted to follow up on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for example, in 2019, I cooperated with the Brücke Museum and curated an exhibition on the Brücke painters during the Nazi period. And I, together with my colleague Aya Zoika, wrote the exhibition catalog, and her part was the years of the Nazi regime, and my part was the years after 1945. And I try to reconstruct the efforts the Brücke painters made to continue with their art career and to rebuild their lives, you know. But it was very important that the art was misused again by the politics in another way, of course, in a positive way, but it was instrumentalized, you can say, because after 1945, the artists that were defamed by the Nazis, of course, were now the victims. Although many artists, for example, like Emil Nolde, who was also a member of the Brücke artist group for a short time only, but we know today that Emil Nolde was a Nazi himself. And so you have to look at artists and their works who were defamed. And you cannot say in general that all defamed artists were victims of the Nazi campaign. So it was very important for me that Germany, who needed a compensation for the lost war and who needed heroes, they tried via their artists, you know, because this was the easiest way, because Germany was convinced these were victims from the Nazis. We don't have to exonerate them or something like that. So they were stylized like heroes.
Are there one or two artists that stood out to you who were indeed victims of the Nazis and either were able to excel after the war or were never able to recover their careers?
Oh, there are a lot of artists that were not able to continue with their career, especially the artist who started their career in the 1920s, but who were not able to be successful in the first years, and then after 1933 were defamed or restricted in their professions. And then in many, many cases, they were not able to bridge these 12 years, you know. Also because the Nazis tried to what is that, umschulen, to convince the artist. The artists were, in a way, they were not, they were defamed, but not persecuted. So the artist didn't have to emigrate only because of their art. This was only the fact for artists who were at the same times of a Jewish background. And so the Nazis tried to keep their artists in Germany, but to change their mind, to change it to a good kind of art in their sense, you know. And in some cases, I think they were successful, because also in the case of the Brücke painters, also they started to paint more harmless landscapes, German landscapes, of course. So in a way, also the Brücke painters tried to find a compromise with the Nazi government and with their own art attitude. And many of the painters did. And especially for the young painters, often that meant that they continued with this kind of art after 1945. So, and these artists really vanished from the scene, vanished from the art scene, or are never mentioned in the art history, you know.
Is your catalog still available?
It is still available. Of course, the title is Escape into Art? The Brücke Painters in the Nazi Period from 2019. And it was published by the Hürmer Verlag in Munich. So it is still available, of course. But when we conducted this project, Aya Zoika, as well as Marei Schmidt, the director of the Brücke Museum, and I realized that the time after the Second World War was very important for the art history of that time, and we still follow these writings of that time, and we still follow the idea of heroes when we talk about expressionists. And we realized that we really have to look deeper into their biographies, because one aspect of the art history after the Second World War was not to mention the Nazi period, and not to mention that or not to look at these artworks, but to look at the artworks that were defamed from the former years, but to cross out the period, so to say, and that is what we have to still to examine more in detail.
There will be a link in the show notes to learn more about Marei. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would be much appreciated if you could leave a rating or review. You can also email your comments to Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com. Until next time, this is Stephanie Draughty bringing you Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What are your plans for the second Saturday of this month? Perhaps consider joining in for a discussion about art, culture, and social issues. Hi everyone, it's Stephanie, and every second Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, I host the Second Saturday Art and Justice Gathering, an online call that explores a range of topics, from artists who might inspire to legal decisions that might infuriate, all with the aim of sparking dialogue about social justice and promoting creative thinking. If interested, please email me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com.